is Philosophy of the People with Stefan Bertram, and God is dead and we have killed him. In important news, Ben is as late as he's ever been. This is not a lateness of just pure unknownness. Rather, Ben said he's going to be very late. Not very more late than now. He said he should be about now. But we were so late that I thought we should probably just begin. The problem was, I'd prepared things to say at the beginning, but they were all going off first asking Ben for an anecdote. Rip Ben, Ben's dead, rip. I was going to ask Ben if he'd ever had a religious experience or a ghostly experience, or some generally kind of spooky experience. And this is in relation, though, as I initially tell it, they won't seem to have any relation at all, with a conversation I had on Reddit Ask Philosophy, where, in regards to ChatGPT and other large language models, ghost. In regards to large language models, I was basically suggesting that in order, if you want to understand these things, hello. Hi. I've only just begun.
Okay, fair enough.
Ben, have you ever had a religious experience?
Depends on how you count it.
Like, I'm asking for anything here. Have you had a religious experience? Have you had, like, a ghost experience? Have you had anything like this?
Uh-huh. I was not expecting this.
Maybe you did the international social salute because you were late.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, let's see. Ghosts, no. I definitely not. I actually remember a friend of mine once telling me that a house that her family owned was haunted, and I was like pressing her on like why exactly she thought so, and
the vibe was off then.
Yeah, exactly. And part of it was that there was like some light bulb that, you know, like that they have that it's like the light bulb kept like unscrewing itself. Right. And so I just kept thinking, okay, so maybe we could have explanation number one is that we're fundamentally wrong about the relationship between consciousness and the physical world. Death is not the end, et cetera, et cetera. Physical causation is not in, you know, a closed system. Option number two is loose socket.
But the thing is, Ben, is that the ghost believer, or the religious experience believer, would say that, you know, this isn't the only datum. And in fact, there's these billions of datums that, you know, most people will tell you about. But was there a religious experience?
Not really. I mean, I was thinking about it. Like, I could certainly, during the, you know, I think in the conventional sense, no. I mean, I think that there's like definitely like times when, you know, back when, you know, I believed in God, when I can like remember particular moments where, you know, I'd be like struck by something and I had like very strong religious feelings or whatever. But like in a real sense, no, not really.
Yeah, me neither. I'm one of those people who's convinced that like if there really were ghosts, I still wouldn't see them. Just because I'm just that strongly like not of that sort.
And I mean like, okay, there's supposed to be all these other data points. But the problem, of course, is that these were all private data points, right? Like that there's no that certainly like anybody who says that they've seen a ghost, this is, you know, it's all take my word for it stuff.
And like if you took four people into a ghostly house and they all said they saw a ghost, but then you took them and separated them and didn't let them confer, the things that they would say would be wildly different.
Yeah, exactly. So it just doesn't seem like, you know, it doesn't seem like right now, you know, I mean, look, by all means, continue the investigations, do the, you know, like, do the paranormal stuff where, you know, you go into the house with the what is it, like the black and white thing that shows you like the energy signatures or whatever, you know, by all means, let's continue the important investigations of like creaky old houses and, you know, see what we come up with. But at present, I don't really think the evidence supports this.
But I was to ask that in the context. I mean, I was hoping you'd had one, but I also it's good that you didn't.
Not really.
So we're on the same level. I want to tell this in the context of a Reddit story.
Okay.
I just began it as you came in.
Sure.
Where I was talking about large language models. And I was suggesting, I think very reasonably, that the best way to understand large language models is not through the user interface. The user interface will massively mislead you to how these things work internally. And what you should do is actually study how these things work internally. And there's some things that we don't know about that, like in some sense, like, we don't quite know how some bits of the LLMs go, and that's kind of the appeal of them, that they in some degree they kind of escape what we directly program them to do, which is kind of why they're better than other stuff. But broadly, we understand what's going on with LLMs, or rather, some people that work on them do, but almost everyone who engages with them doesn't. And so if you're part of this 99.99%, what you should do is try and engage with this material. Which was the internal workings going on. And this got quite a negative reaction from some people who were basically desperate for it to be the case that we don't understand how LLMs work. And I think there's this incredibly strong natural human tendency towards mysticism.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, they're like, they're just really desperate to not, like, for it not to be understood how this thing works. Whatever new thing it is that comes along, people very much want them not to be understood. And I think I'm genuinely going to be more sympathetic to, in a certain way, Peter Hitchens' position in this article, basically on the point that I think it's really hard to be an atheist. I think there's very few people out there who really are atheists, even if they don't believe in God, in the sense that they are actually a thoroughgoing metaphysical atheist who doesn't at all points turn towards trying to find some kind of mysticism or hidden secret mysterious blah blah, you know. Of course I arrogantly exclude myself from that own thing. I think I am a proper atheist.
Sure.
But I think it's hard for people.
Yeah. I'll give you a little bit of an echo. I don't know what's up with that. But To Waba Cohen in my chat, I would just say that every once in a while, like to do a stream about philosophy because philosophy is fun, and that's okay. You know what? Karl Marx would have done YouTube philosophy streams if the technology had been available to him.
I mean, the problem with if the internet had been around where Marx was around, he would have got no work done. And we never would have looked.
Yeah, no, exactly. In fact, he would have done so many streams to, like, you know, yell at people about, you know, interpreting Hegel wrong and things like that, that, you know, he never would have read Capital. So really, thank God there was no 19th century YouTube. But yeah, I think that this is, you know, we do mostly politics. Not everything has to be politics. Feel free not to watch.
Yeah, I mean, it's a philosophy show. If you're not interested in philosophy, fuck off.
It's funny. I was just thinking somehow that seems like the more British way to say it, which is funny because I also think of being like politely evasive is more British. But like, I think that both politely evasive and fuck off.
Well, if I was the proprietor of Give Them an Argument, I would say what you said. But in of the fact that I'm not the proprietor, I'll say the other thing.
Yeah, fair enough. In any case, yeah, no, being a proper atheist, I mean, look, if the question is just, do you feel some sort of temptation towards like non-material explanations of things, I do, right? I mean, we're all like weird, hyper primed up pattern recognition bots, and it's not like, it's certainly not like I'm immune from that, right? That the seeing patterns and things that aren't really there, thinking that something was supposed to happen, whatever. Even though in the abstract, I think that's all very dumb, right? That's still, sure. I mean, I think that's things people are going to do. I mean, certainly I think that it's very psychologically difficult to like really internalize the idea that you're going to die. And that's that, right? That, as you know, I always think of Saul Bellow's novel, Ravelstein, guy says, nobody really believes the picture stop, right? You're sort of trying to imagine stopping existing and like nobody can really do it.
I mean, I won't be there, will I?
Yeah, exactly. So we kind of try, we're so primed to imagine things in terms of our, future perceptions of them, that we try to perceive, think that like, oh, there's something we're perceiving. We're sort of thinking of like fading to blackness or something. It's like, no, there's just nothing, you just don't have a perspective anymore. There is no you to have a perspective.
Yeah, you're not in the void. There just isn't a you.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I will say that I think that as difficult as that is, both sort of, conceptually and emotionally, I do think that I'm pretty, in 2020 and 2021, I kind of had a, there were a couple of people who were really important to me who died in both cases very unexpectedly. And this all happened while there was a global pandemic going on. So I couldn't really like go out or talk to anybody. I spent a while in a pretty bad place, and I've always thought since then, it's like, probably not gonna ever start believing in life after death. Cause if I was going to, this would have definitely been the time. I don't think that's like take a bow or anything. I think that's just like, for whatever reason, I think I've just, got into a point in my life where I seem to be psychologically immunized from that, I think that there definitely are things about sort of internalizing a kind of, atheistic, materialist worldview that are very difficult. Whether that means that like we can't have a civilization or we're just going to be a bit angsty about it, though, is a different question.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it is interesting. I was thinking because I wasn't, I guess it wasn't that surprising that the debate that the article that Ben wrote about this week between the Hitchens brothers, Christopher and Peter. And then he called one of them Stephen. I don't think it's a Stephen.
What's that?
And then he called one of them Stephen before remembering they called Peter and
Christopher. Oh, yeah. Who can forget Stephen Hitchens? He would be like in the Hitchens household, well, Christopher and Peter were both, 12, and they were, screaming at each other about God and Trotskyism. then, you know, Stephen was always just sitting there, you know, trying to eat his breakfast cereal and not get involved.
Yeah, now he's a bank manager.
exactly.
But yeah, I mean, it was kind of a disappointment that this the debate, at least the article wasn't very good. Yeah, it was shit this week, man. No, the debate between Peter and Christopher just didn't seem very good. They didn't really seem to get at each other's points, and Peter seemed to basically just be saying things which were like self-contradictory, being like, you know, if we stop believing in God, then Southampton will end up like it was in the 14th century where everyone believed in God. Like, it was just not very good.
Yeah. I mean, I think that really what this did, I mean, you know, I should back up and say part of why this is interesting to me is obviously I wrote a book about Christopher Hitchens. And in that book, I wrote about both of his two previous big debates with Peter in 1999 and 2008. And I've, you know, done Thursday Night Debate breakdowns on my channel a long time ago on both of those. And, you know, this one was a new discovery for me. I didn't know it existed until pretty recently, partly because, weirdly enough, it doesn't seem to be preserved on YouTube. Like I can't find a video of it anywhere, but you know, there is a transcript that's available from the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, which was the hosting organization. And so, you know, certainly for me, this is like, you know, definitely, you know, my ears perked up when I found out that this existed. And in a certain sense, this is actually the topic. This is actually the religion topic you want these guys to debate, because in both of their cases, really, I think that one thing that neither of them really, you know, showed much aptitude for, you know, are really interested in, right, is actually arguing about the existence of God. Right. This is back in, you know, last year, you know, spring or something last year, I did a couple of essays about the Hitchens William Lane Craig debate, which is the sort of most dramatic illustration of this fact as far as Christopher goes, that, you know, when he's actually arguing with a philosopher of religion who really knows his stuff, like William Lane Craig, it really comes out very quickly how kind of hopeless he is about
like destiny.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not. Have you seen all of that, by the way?
I haven't seen any of it. Like, why?
Not the 5-hour debate. I haven't watched that yet. Right. I suppose I will subject myself to that sooner or later. But like right afterward, like right after the debate, people dug up, I believe Destiny himself dug up, but in any case, I think he was at least
the fact that Norman Finkelstein is really Jewish.
Yeah, like he was basically
they dug up the fact that he's a completely stereotypical New York Jew.
Yes, that they have
a certain age.
That he's like a crotchety elderly Jewish man who
writes written complaints about his neighbors because they're too loud.
Yes, which is I have to say I was singularly unshocked by, not just because, you know, of his general persona, but also because like he's literally complained about his neighbors to me on stream before. But this was being dug up, and I posted, you know, I admitted at the beginning of the tweet, right? It's like, look, I have not watched the debate yet. It's 5 hours, but if people are digging up personal dirt about Norm, that probably tells me that they don't have a good response to him on the substance of the point. And Destiny himself quote tweeted this angrily and said, you know, oh, I see. So, you know, whatever happens, right? This is Like it's just going to confirm your worldview if
right, Norman. You basically seem to confuse the point that Norman Finkelstein was making in the debate, which is you're a moron who doesn't know anything and should stop talking. In other terms, kind of intellectual attacks, with what he was doing, which is presumably meant to not be an intellectual attack because that wouldn't make any sense, but presumably was meant to be a moral attack. And there obviously is a distinction there, with it being kind of irrelevant that Norman Finkelstein is an asshole if he is an asshole. While Destiny being a moron who doesn't know anything is very relevant when you're doing an intellectual debate.
Yeah, I mean, if Norm is rude, then, that's, I don't know what to say about that. They don't like Norm is rude.
I wouldn't, but it would suck to be his neighbor, but I'm not.
sure, exactly. Doesn't really mean he's wrong about Palestine. And if, but
if Destiny is wrong about Palestine, it means he's wrong about Palestine.
Yeah, exactly. And I believe, didn't see everything that was going around, I'm sure, but I definitely saw a couple. But I believe the sort of heart of Norm's barbs were that Destiny didn't seem to know very much about the topic. I think that was the crux of it. So, Destiny's tweet was like, if Norm insults me, then it's epic, and that shows that I'm wrong. And if I dig up completely irrelevant personal dirt on Norm, then that shows that I'm wrong, so everything shows that I'm wrong, see, this is just like what happens when you go down an ideological rabbit hole. And, so I restricted myself to just saying one further thing about this response, which is just, can you please point me to the places where I was talking about how epic Norm's insults were? Cause I really don't remember doing that. Right. Or for that matter, ever using the word epic, as certainly as an adjective, in my life. But in any case, I am going to be curious. I don't know when I'm gonna find 5 hours to sit down and watch it, but I am kind of curious to do so.
I mean, you could just live stream the whole thing. That would be content if you did it. Hassan did that, but it took him 12 hours because he kept pausing.
Yeah. I wonder with minimal pause in how long that would take. That kind of feels like just find a day. That's the thing that I'm gonna do.
But I think the Hitchens debate would be much more interesting.
Yes. Fair enough. Yeah. So look, neither of those guys, got distracted by this bizarreness. It's classic. Epic. There you go. A word that I so often use. In any case, so neither of these guys, I think, really has much aptitude for actually arguing about the existence of God. If you read Christopher's book, God Is Not Great, in that context, he does run through some of the arguments for the existence of God. And he does say reasonable things about what's wrong with some of them. If you look at, I think his introduction to that Portable Atheist book, he does talk a little bit about the problem of evil there. I think certainly some of the readings he includes do, but really most times I've seen him in debates where those things would have been relevant, he just forgets to bring them up because this is just not material he's particularly comfortable with. And, he doesn't feel at home in it. It doesn't occur to him. And by contrast, I would similarly, Peter just doesn't bother really with any of that stuff. In fact, if anything, in cases where, in the debate he did in 2008 with Christopher, the half of the evening was spent arguing about Iraq and the other half about God. and he actually, you know, Peter actually, you know, since the two of them didn't agree on anything, Peter actually got a rock right, you know, is the, that's maybe his best moment. But in the God part, you know, as far as I can sort of infer what the implicit argument was, it's that we should take a leap of faith for the sake of, like, I don't know, public order or something, that, you know, that they have that, like, that, you know, for, you know, essentially for the sake of civilization. And, you know, Christopher is really much more interested in making a utilitarian argument against, you know, like the consequences of religious belief, as well as sort of explaining why he thinks standard moral religious beliefs are morally abhorrent, than he is in actually arguing about whether they're true. So, you know, I actually think that in a sense, it's like, yeah, can civilization survive without God? Yeah, this is the religion topic that I want to see these guys argue about, because this is actually the one that plays to what, you know, both of them, I think, are really interested in. But that said, you know, I think that even there, I think that Peter was a bit inconsistent in ways that I think, to be fair, are not uncommon for people who take the kind of position that he takes. But I think he is a bit inconsistent in telling an interest in ways. And I think that really showing what was wrong with some of what he was saying would have required, yeah, actually going into the philosophy part, which is probably why Christopher didn't really do it. Right. You know, that he's not, you know, he wasn't great on that. So this is, and in some ways, I mean, really, like, this really is a really funny experience to me, at least reading the transcript of this debate, because on the one hand, like, I've always really enjoyed, you know, watching these guys. Like, obviously, I think that I have severe disagreements with both of them. You know, Christopher, I think, was catastrophically wrong on most obviously Iraq and, you know, a cluster of other issues in his last years. But, you know, but, like, that's kind of the big one. You know, in a line that I ended up having to delete for the sake of, you know, keeping this down to 3,000 words. You know, I ended up deleting the whole set.
You kept the whole big thing about, and then I was drinking ouzo in Athens, mate.
Yeah. So yeah, like in a part that I ended up getting rid of, I said that, that I think that, you know, if I believed in an afterlife, I would think that Christopher is probably in purgatory right now, not for his religious beliefs. I think a just God would be willing to excuse those as a epistemically rational response to the evidence with which he was presented, you know, through the glass darkly and all that. But you know, basically for his stance on Iraq, right? I think that's really catastrophically wrong, but he was right about a lot of other things. Peter is right about that. But, you know, otherwise I find the man's entire worldview just, you know, bizarrely and almost charmingly alien to me. Right. I mean, it's like the sort of pleasure that you get from a certain kind of historical fiction where you're being asked to identify with people in a completely, you know, different society with almost incomprehensible values. Peter Hitchens is, like, very worried about how dangerous marijuana is. You know, he writes about that.
I was just listening to him because he went on Navarra Media today, and I happened to see it just before. So I was like, I'll get myself hyped on Peter Hitchens. And I was listening to him talk about the Bush education system, and I was completely sympathetic to what he was saying.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's also just very critical of, as far as I can tell, most things.
Yeah. But he's just making the point that, you know, he's for selective schools, as in schools which you have to take an exam to go to or whatever, or have certain whatevers. based on merit. And, you know, Aaron Bastani was like, well, does this not kind of determine how your life goes at 11? And he's like, well, it does, but our current system is our life is determined at 11 by how much money your parents have. And how you do in exams is at least a bit better than that in terms of choosing for some kind of genuine merit and for helping children from poor families, as opposed to the current system where it's not nearly as bad as the US property system to education funding is in the US, but it's still obviously the fact that in the UK, in poor places, the schools are bad, and in rich places, the schools are good.
Yeah. Yeah, right. I mean, look, I don't know that much about how the system works there. I mean, I think that it's good if there are, like, I think it's good for there to be second and third chances built in, right? Like that, you know, that's important. But yeah, I certainly take the point about, you know, I mean, tests. Like, this is something that...
Because it's happening now, right, in the US, that they're getting rid of standardized testing to get into college. And that basically means they're reducing how much it matters of all the things. And that basically means poor kids who don't know how to game the system, who don't have these other things, can't outcompete rich children who have all the extra extracurricular blah, 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 know how to write these statements, blah, blah, blah.
Totally, yeah. I mean, in fact, the advantages that you get from like SAT tutors on the test, like quantitatively, it doesn't actually seem to give you all that big a boost, right? Mm-hmm. Like this is, whereas the advantage for having people like help you with your stupid fucking admissions essay where you talk about all the disadvantages that, you know, you overcome, you know, you come up with some stuff to spin as disadvantages, the advantages that you get from having like lots of time to work on that and, you know, lots of people to help you and give you suggestions and all that stuff are really tremendous. Right. You know, I mean, the people, you know, I mean, the, like, look, I think that the people who this is the current system, you know, insofar as there are a lot of colleges now that are, you know, de-emphasizing test scores and all that stuff, and what matters are, you know, beyond grades or, you know, like admissions essays. I think that the people who that most benefits are people who have plausible claims to, you know, some sort of marginality, but also lots of money.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, no. So he's definitely not always wrong. He is also, you know, but he's very, but yes, he's very, he's very curmudgeonly. He
thinks the Tory party are Eurocommunist.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And he was always writing about how, you know, Tony Blair and his associates, you know, were like, nobody asked them enough about their, you know, their past as like radical Trotskyists in their youth, you know, and stuff like that. You know, it's really like, yeah, there are some like pretty wild reactionary views there. And he's also just, I think he's also just sort of instinctively critical of like most things. I don't think he feels any particular need to, you know, throw in his hat with a political project he thinks is going to succeed. I think, he just
declared the Conservative Party doomed 17 years ago.
Yeah, and like, so that first debate with Christopher at the one at Conway Hall in 1999 was essentially about what would much later be called Brexit. And in bringing it up to him when he was a guest on my show, you know, I sort of said that he was like, oh, well, actually, I didn't vote in the Brexit referendum. I didn't like either campaign. So it's like, all right.
I didn't vote either. So
that's, you know, that sounds about right. Yeah. But like you also hadn't spent years advocating that Britain leave the European Union before the vote. So
it was actually in Athens when the vote happened.
Yeah. Yeah. Fun city. This is, you know, and it actually will be interesting to see if Peter, who's still very much with us, takes any notice of the essay, because he did actually write a extremely long and involved response in his like Mail on Sunday blog thing to something I'd written about him about a year ago. So, you know, you never know. But in any case, you know, Peter, I think in this debate is alternating between a few different positions in ways that are common for people who have kind of a strong intuition that there's a really deep connection between God and morality, but don't necessarily spend enough time thinking about philosophy as such to sort of really clearly disambiguate like what they think that connection is. So during much of the debate, his position seems to be that if people stop believing in God, then they'll stop acting morally, or even if they don't, right, they'll stop educating their children to act morally, or, you know, even if they don't, because, you know, they're pansy intellectuals, you know, that then the other people they influence to stop believing in God, you know, will stop acting morally. That seems to be his position for a lot of it. And I think most of what he says is only really coherent if you assume that that's what he thinks. But there are also definitely points where he's making a different claim. And in fact, sometimes he's even kind of giving up on the first claim to just focus on this one. In that, you know, the second claim would be, okay, well, maybe you can still be moral, but the you just don't have like a coherent answer to where morality comes from, or you just end up being some kind of weird moral relativist or something like that, right? He says that without belief in God, there's no magnetic north, you know, to define morality. And it's a little bit confusing, though, because if you go with the first one, that no, just as an empirical prediction, people who don't believe in God are going to start acting as if everything is permitted, then you do have some obvious problems, right? One is that, there seem to be all these civilizations where, you know, that are not only non-Christian, but, you know, don't have anything like, you know, monotheistic religious belief, right? Or maybe to the extent that there's some sort of religion, it just doesn't really revolve around gods in the same way. And yet, you know, there are places, you know, like Asia, most obviously, where historically, right, before Christianity was brought there, and to a very great extent now, depending on the country we're talking about, where, you have religions, right? But you certainly don't have anything like the idea that, you know, that there's a singular God who lays down commandments, and, you know, this grounds right and wrong or anything like that, right?
And I mean now, right, China is, you know, the only really committed state atheist state left in the world, and of renown for having safe streets.
Right. Yes, very true. I have in fact seen The Purge. I've actually, for better or worse, I won't claim they're all equally good, but I've seen every single Purge movie. I did a movie stream on that with KT Baldessaro, who actually had a bit part in one of them. She was the flag faced killer in the Purge election year. But yes. It seems that it seems that you can have very high, you know, like very low degrees of religiosity in China, for example, without it being the purge every day. And, you know, he sort of, Peter says a couple of things in passing that make it sound like, well, okay, but there's this particular combination of order and liberty that, you know, we've had in like Anglo societies, and that maybe you need Christianity for. But it's confusing because, you know, a quick glance at the relevant statistics will tell you that there's like a higher percentage of the population that doesn't believe in God where you are than where I am. And there's a higher percentage of the population that doesn't believe in God in, say, Sweden than there is where you are. And yet, not only is it not the purge in Sweden, despite the fact that you could say, oh, China's authoritarian, whatever, it's like, Sweden's a pretty, Sweden's a pretty free country, right? You know, it's I don't really know what the liberties are that are enjoyed by Brits that are enjoyed by Swedes.
It is true in Sweden, they're one of the very few weird countries where it's illegal to be high on drugs.
Interesting. All right.
But yeah, it's interesting. I was reading an article today about how
Can you be drunk? Is that okay?
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't know. Maybe drunk in public is illegal or whatever, you know. Okay, that's a separate matter, right? You know, intoxication can be illegal in Sweden when in other countries, in Britain, certainly, if you're incredibly high in cocaine but don't have any cocaine, which is not inside of you, then you're all right. As long as it's all inside, then you're fine.
I think even in the U.S., I mean, it's you know, I think like there are laws about, you know, like public intoxication.
In Sweden, they can arrest you for being high on weed, like in your house. Obviously, it doesn't happen because how would that happen?
How would they, right? But theoretically, they could, yeah. In the U.S., I believe it is legal to incredibly high in the privacy of your own home, even if you're in a state where the things that got you that way are illegal. It still seems to be the case that, in fact, not only is it not the purge in Sweden, right, but the homicide rate, for example, is lower there than it is in the UK, which is in turn lower than it is in the US, from which I certainly wouldn't conclude that atheism, leads people to commit fewer crimes, but just that
the domesticates you.
Yeah. That the two issues seem to be largely unrelated. In fact, you know, I mean, like one of the funniest things, as you already alluded to in Peter's presentation, was that he said that, you know, he's talking about the idea that, you know, that as sort of civilization declined, because people, you know, didn't believe in a source of ultimate authority, and there's no magnetic north and all of that, that things would eventually regress to like about the condition of the 13th or 14th century, you know, when you didn't want to be outside your home, you know, when it was dark. And that's confusing because, one thing I'm pretty sure of in about the 13th or 14th century is that there was very little atheism. There's actually, as far as I know, right? In fact, there's a really fun...
It's probably like almost impossible as an individual to be an atheist. Like, it wouldn't occur to you, right? Like, at the time, atheist was used as to mean heterodox.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much right. So Alec Ryrie actually has a lecture for Gresham College that the UCLA algorithm recommended to me years ago, which is really interesting, called How to Be an Atheist in Medieval Europe, where he sort of goes through what evidence there is of people who expressed, you know, atheist views in medieval Europe. And yeah, it does seem to be the case that most people who are accused of that weren't, right? Like not just that paranoia or whatever, that that people who, you know, were completely godly people were accused of that, but also that there wasn't a lot of distinction made between, you know, not believing in God and just being like a horrible scoundrel.
There was lots of people who didn't give a shit about religion, but if you asked them, like, was Jesus Christ born and died and resurrected, they'd be like, yeah, I mean, it says in the only book I own, so why not?
Yeah. I mean, so that one of the comparisons that Ryrie uses in that video, and, you know, all of his lectures are really interesting. I'm curious about his own views. They're a little hard to infer from some of this, but, you know, like he has a lot of, you know, but he does a bunch of videos about the kind of history of religion that are all interesting to watch. And, you know, one of the things he points out is that the sort of valence of being an actual atheist in this era, right? I mean, the few people who may have actually found their way to that position was kind of the opposite of what it's been since, right? Because, like, if you're an atheist in medieval Europe, you're somebody who thinks that, like, basically everything that everybody who's ever read a book tells you is wrong, right?
Yeah, so, but like, the only really real major educational institution in your country is completely wrong about everything.
Yeah, exactly, right? So he sort of says it's like the equivalent of like somebody you like meet at a bar who thinks that like is the earth really going around the sun? I mean, like, sure, doesn't seem to be moving to me.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, everything that they produce in universities is wrong. It's the equivalent of that.
Yeah, exactly. So terribly little atheism, almost no atheism, and yet extremely unsafe streets. Sweden today, tons of atheism, aside from the, you know, inebriation law, seems like a fair amount of liberty, and also, you know, a good amount of public order. You know, people are, I think actually, the just because I was looking these numbers up, I obviously didn't include most of this, but I think they must have slightly less strict gun laws than the UK, because the rate of like gun homicides is higher in Sweden than the UK, but like the overall rate of homicides is much lower, and it's
also a lot to do with Balkan immigrants.
Okay.
Who kind of run, there's lots of Balkan immigrants from Balkan refugees in Sweden, and for obvious reasons, Yugoslavs run like the gun networks of Europe. And also, Swedish military bases used to be ridiculously easy to steal from.
Okay.
Swedish outlaw biker gangs would just steal. They like stole like a ground to air anti-aircraft missile and launched it at, like, another group's clubhouse. Well, obviously, because it was an anti-aircraft missile, obviously it was like a big physical thing, but the payload is like 5 kilograms. So it didn't kill anyone, I think. Or maybe it killed one person, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I now really want to see the Swedish reboot of Sons of Anarchy. That sounds like a great show, but yeah, I think,
you got just thrown by that.
That's awesome. I love that.
I was Googling Nordic biker war, so I can send it to you.
All right. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. So it doesn't really seem like there's much of an obvious connection, and, you know, in fact, you know, there's also, you know, one of the funniest things that happened in this debate was the point where they're arguing about whether like certain kinds of acts of interpersonal violence, you know, would have been just like unthinkable when they were growing up, which is what Peter thinks, or whether they're the sorts of things that probably always happen, which is what, you know, Christopher has suggested. And it ends up getting very personal that, you know, that Christopher says, look, it's not like when we grew up, our parents would have told us just go out, you know, anywhere you like, and, you know, Portsmouth at night, you know, go to the train station, docks, whatever, it's fine.
But then Peter makes the point that actually our parents would only be worried about class contagion in that case.
Yeah, exactly. He was like, yeah, I remember them warning us against like the rough boys or whatever, but I'm pretty sure those boys didn't actually pose that much danger. I think the main danger was that mom was afraid that we'd pick up their accents. That said, as funny as that is, I did also, you know, look this up, and the actual crime rate in Britain had been declining for like a couple decades by the time they had this debate, even as presumably the rate of godlessness was, you know, continuing to go up, you know, that is just as it generally has in, you know, the late 20th century and early 21st century, and, you know, and as people like Peter's brother were, you know, doing their best to help it along, which would suggest that these things really don't have much to do with each other. And as indeed is the fact that, you know, the people who think the most about there not being a god are really very unlikely to engage in a lot of street violence.
It's actually a really incredibly interesting social phenomenon that if you look at real wages, we haven't got anywhere since the 1980s. The real wages of American workers are, I think, just slightly below in real dollar terms what they were in 1980. Men have seen like a large real decline, while women have seen a large real increase. But across the proletariat, it basically evens out. While at the same time, we've seen a massive decline in crime. I think it's this absolutely fascinating social phenomenon going on in the West, where crime is continuing to drop and drop and drop, despite the fact that we aren't getting richer, we aren't becoming more prosperous. But a conversation about this isn't really possible because everyone is convinced at all times that crime is getting worse, right?
Yeah, right. I think it is an interesting question why it's dropped in that period. I think there might be like a few plausible explanations that
include... I assume a lot of it is to do with the fact that it's really hard to do organized crime anymore unless you're in like a deep ghetto.
Right. Yeah. So I think certainly, certainly like just the proliferation of cameras, has made certain kinds of crime much more difficult. And I do also think that we've gotten much better over time at, detecting organized crime. I think that's right. So I think that's definitely part of it. I also think there are like certain kinds of petty crime that might have like literally just declined because like people have more entertainment options. As silly as that sounds, right? I think that might actually be true.
You're too busy gaming to throw stones through people's windows.
yeah, exactly. Be the opposite. Like maybe the truth is actually the opposite of that classic Simpsons episode where Marge does her crusade against violence on television, and she convinces the company that does Itchy and Scratchy to take out all the violence, and now that it's boring, all the kids stop watching, and there's this scene where they all flow out into the street and they're flying kites and playing in the sunshine and everything's wonderful. It's like, no, maybe it's the opposite. You know, that's like, this is what's keeping the rock throwers preoccupied at home. I think it's also that said, right, while there has been that general trend, which definitely does go to how multi-causal this stuff is, it is also the case that I think economic conditions do still tell us a lot about country by country comparative crime statistics, that, the U.S. murder rate, you know, it's not as bad as it was a few decades ago, for sure, right? But, you know, it's also pretty horrifying compared to, like, most developed countries, that, you know, it's really unusually high by global standards. And I think that does have a lot to do with, you know, with economic conditions. And I think there's even statistical evidence that, that, you know, there's quite a bit of, that there is at least some effect to even pretty incremental, economic changes, like minimum wage increases, you know, jobs programs, you know, earned income tax credit. You know, it's like things, even things like this do actually seem to have a statistically noticeable, you know, effect. And, you know, I think really jobs more than anything, you know, so like, I think that when Peter says, and it makes for good rhetoric, but if you actually think about it, when Peter says things like, oh, well, you know, these people who are engaged in these, like, grisly acts of violence, that, you know, that he's using as anecdotes, that these are, you know, I like to call them practical atheists, because they probably don't know the word atheist, but, you know, they're acting, you know, they're like, they clearly, you know, don't, you know, they clearly don't believe, you know, have any constraint, you know, from Christian religion. It's like, okay, but let's really think about the practical atheists and the, you know, the atheist atheists, right? Because it's like, clearly your, you know, fancy intellectual atheists are not, in fact, to use Peter's favorite example, kicking people's heads in over petty arguments, you know, that they're not doing that. Why not? Right? Well, it seems to be the case that interpersonal violence of all kinds is correlated with economic conditions, that people, you know, that that, you know, pretty much every kind of interpersonal violence happens more among people who are living in, you know, who are living in worse economic conditions. And, you know, there's a complicated argument to be had about why that is. In some cases, it's obvious, right? Like, people are, you know, gonna, you know, people are a lot more likely to join gangs in the areas with lots of poverty and unemployment, and that's not a mystery to anybody, right? In other cases, there's a more interesting question about, you know, how, you know, about, like, the how the causation works out. But I think that the fact of it is pretty clear on its face. And I think once you really internalize that, once you start looking at the country by country statistics about atheism and crime, it just, this idea that there is, that, you know, people will start acting as if they're, you know, liberated from moral constraints once they become atheists, I think just doesn't really pan out as an empirical prediction, right? Like, and none of this is to say that, like, I don't think that there's any connection between these things empirically. I think there might be. I think that there are. In fact, I talk about this in my book about Hitchens. I think that, you know, there are certain kinds of moral heroism that I think you might be more likely to engage in if you're religious, that, you know, that, like, not because of any sort of conceptual connection between God and morality, but just because maybe as a psychological fact, if, you know, you sort of associate your moral feelings with this sense of transcendence in the numinous, you know, this might actually help inspire people to certain kinds of supererogatory acts, you know, like going above and beyond the call, whether it's like, oh, I'm gonna adopt a bunch of orphans from Ukraine, or I don't know, that, you know, you're like the sorts of acts of moral heroism you might get when you're, like, resisting the Nazis or something like that, right? That you know, you might get a higher rate of those things. Now, what somebody like Christopher...
Catholic priests really peaked during the Holocaust. It's been downhill since then.
And even there, notoriously mixed bag.
Mixed bag.
Yes. Like, you know, you definitely had some Catholic priests who were, like, heroically anti-Nazi. But, you know, you also had an awful lot who you know, said mass, said their mass, and you know, started with the legally required prayer for the Führer, and you know, did exactly what they were supposed to do the entire time.
The argument that I was hoping Peter would make, which is at least interesting, would be this kind of like meta-historical one, that you know, the very first institutions of civilization, whatever you want to call it, were grain stores, which were temples, and temples, which were grain stores. And then since then, you know, in ancient civilizations, it was normal for the leader of these states to either be the head of, you know, the cult, or to be proclaimed divine themselves. Catholic medieval Europe was obviously centered around the Catholic Church. And then into modernity, what mostly happened outside of France was the monarch and the head of the state and the head of the religion became identical. And so you had this thousands and thousands of years of human civilization where the state or civilization, whatever you want to call it, was deeply, deeply embedded with God and with religion. And what we have now in the past couple hundred years, where this is starting to fray, though obviously, you know, I live in a country where the king is the head of the church. Though obviously, in the reality, it doesn't really mean anything.
Although that's gotta feel like, I mean, if you're like a really devout Anglican, it's like that guy is the head of your church. I mean, that's gotta.
I really love how formally reactionary the British Constitution is. There's only two states in the world where bishops sit in the upper house. And one of them is the UK.
What's the other one?
I can't remember. People always think it's Iran, but I think it isn't Iran. At least in Iran, in the upper house, it's like the upper house is elected in Iran. I think it's formed of religious clerics, but it's elected. So it doesn't really count. I think it's the country that used to be called Swaziland.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, I don't really know what the Shiite equivalent would be of a bishop anyway, but...
And they don't really have that kind of structure anyway, so... But they have a religious upper parliament, but it's elected from a selected list.
Yeah.
It's not like the UK where bishops are guaranteed seats in the House of Lords.
Yeah, that's amazing.
But yeah, the argument I'd hope, you know, Peter would have made was, you know, we have this immense history of civilization, then we have this civilization which is now, and obviously lots of things have gone wrong in the past couple centuries. You know, we've been threatened with the end of civilization from nuclear war and so on. It hasn't happened, and we've become very prosperous. But, you know, there is this kind of question of like, well, it hasn't been going for very long. If we can call ourselves now atheists, then, you know, we don't really know what can happen in the future. But instead he made pretty shit arguments. Which seemed to constantly contradict himself. Like, starting from the Somalia thing seemed like...
Yeah, right.
Like, he should have been like Russia in the 90s or something. At least then he could maybe get to atheism.
Yeah, which is, you know, and to be fair, I mean, you know, I think he did also bring up Russia. He started in Somalia, which is the more dramatic example. So he's describing, you know, being a journalist in Somalia just before George Bush Sr. sent in the Marines in the early 90s. And, you know, it really is like a post-apocalyptic science fiction movie. And, you know, he paints a very vivid and horrible picture of what that was like, that, you know, that you're, you know, met at the airport by a bunch of, you know, that there's like, by a bunch of guys in AK-47s, and they asked if you want to hire a bodyguard, and the guy from the Associated Press says, "Yeah, you better, or you're gonna die." You know, like drive around in cars. They've been like stripped of all the upholstery and like people, and you know, everything's on fire. And you know, if they didn't find just the right place to spend the night, they would have probably died, etc. And then he, a couple of weeks after coming back to Britain, he sees this picture of Mogadishu from 20 years earlier, where it's like this very pleasant street that, you know, like the exact street he was just on, where, you know, lined with shops and, you know, people driving by in expensive cars and all this stuff. And you know, his point is, okay, say civilization can be here and then go away, which is fair enough. But of course, sure doesn't have anything to do with God, because as Christopher and I think one the guy from The Economist both pointed out at the Pew Forum, look, Somalia's got a million problems, but lack of religious belief is not one of them, right? Like, this is, you know, go, you know, take a glance at one of the State Department, you know, reports on, you know, the state of freedom of religion in Somalia, and it's not great.
We've got lots of guns, lots of God, and lots of kids.
Yeah. That's neither the central government, to the extent that that controls stuff, nor the alternatives are, you know, particularly atheistic. So that's, you know, and Peter sort of grants the point, right? He says, look, this is, and, you know, I'm not saying that that's what happened in Somalia. I'm just saying civilization can go away. And you're right. Russia would have been a better example. He does bring up Russia later. And of course, his book, Raid, The Rage Against God, which I've actually read. It's an interesting book. It's very strange, but it's interesting and, you know, very well written. He talks a lot about Russia there for the same point. And yeah, there you can at least say, hey, you had several decades of, you know, official atheism. So you can, you know, blame that to some extent, you know, for the woes of this society. Although even there, right, it's like, well, I mean, seems like.
I mean, 1992 wasn't the atheists winning, was it? They lost.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and in fact, as you know, he doesn't directly connect it to Peter's point, but as Christopher does point out elsewhere in the debate, it's one of a couple things that made this feel sort of freakishly contemporary, even though this is 14 years ago. You know, that Russia today, right? You know, that Putin is very closely allied with the Russian Orthodox Church, and you know, derives like a certain amount of legitimacy, you know, from that association, and, you know, like famously gives them things they want, like, you know, like anti-gay laws. If I were an anarcho-capitalist, Somalia might not be a country I'd be eager to bring up. But in any case, that's, you know, the other thing that made it feel very, very contemporary was that, you know, so Christopher has a point where he's like, look, let's think about, you know, the link between, you know, how we want our civilization to develop and religion. And, you know, he says, imagine that you heard that there was a opposition leader in Iran who had lots of support for the population, who said he didn't believe in the, you know, coming to the 12th Imam, and that sounded like a fairy tale to him. Wouldn't you be happy to hear that? Or then he said, or imagine that Bibi Netanyahu, on one of his regular trips to the United States to humiliate our president, announced that he was severing his coalition with Rabbi Ovadiah. I feel like I'm getting that slightly wrong. Yosef, who's this you know, super crazy Israeli rabbi who is the head of the religious part of Netanyahu's coalition at that point, who would do things like pray for, you know, God to like send a plague to smite the Palestinians. And it's like, yeah, if this man was no longer going to be part of the government, wouldn't you be happy about that? Which, you know, I think is all kind of fair enough as far as it goes. You know, these examples do all sound like they would be good news, all else being equal. But I think that...
It feels like on the Iran one, at least, that Hitchens, that Peter could just bite the bullet. And go, yeah. Like, you know, I don't think that would actually go very well, actually.
Yeah, maybe. And certainly, like, all of these are examples about people who draw horrific reactionary conclusions from religious belief and how that's bad. And that's true. But the problem is that there are also people who draw the opposite conclusion from their religious beliefs, you know, that there are you know, nuns who, you know, pour blood on nuclear weapons silos, that there are, you know, there are those priests who resisted Hitler. There's that, you know, John Brown thought, you know, God, you know, wanted him to go fight the slavers and, you know, in Kansas.
Really wanted him to decapitate white boys.
Well, you know, depends on the white boy in particular and which, and you know, what they've done. I'm, you know, critical support for John Brown, but like,
critical support for John Brown.
But, you know, there are rabbis who, you know, who go to, you know, who lead, you know, peace protests and, you know, whatever. So like, so there's no guarantee there. And like, frankly, religious people in that second category, I greatly prefer to the politics of many people who agree with me and Christopher about metaphysics. Right? Like this, you know, that, you know, in the book I mentioned, you know, sort of examples about, you know, people, for example, you know, like most libertarians.
We talked about it last week, right? Like about Dawkins or whatever, switching sides in the culture war.
Yeah, totally. Right. And or like, yeah, most libertarians seem to be atheists. That's, you know, certainly if you're like an Ayn Rand acolyte, that's like a very important part of your worldview. Is,
yeah. I mean, there are Randian Christians, right, aren't there? But it's such a disgusting idea.
I don't understand how that works.
I mean, it can't really, if you had to think about it. Like, you yeah, can't think Christ is king and think you're like a sovereign, whatever, you know.
Yeah, because it does seem to me that whatever else you can say one way or the other about Christianity, you know, Jesus is pretty clear that you should also, you're also supposed to give a shit about other people.
But, you know, like Rand Paul isn't called that by accident, is he?
Yeah, it was, yeah, right. Ron Paul probably named him after after Ayn Rand. Yeah, no, I mean, I'm sure there are people who you know, in fact, I know there are people who are, you know, devout Christians who, you know, like Ayn Rand just because she was so anti-communist. But how much time they've actually spent thinking about how to piece together those worldviews, it would be interesting to know, right? I'd be very, very curious about that. But yeah, like, you know, so yeah, they've got a line in the book about, you know, atheist libertarians who, you know, whose idea of utopia would be a society where people are, you know, there's a free market for people to sell their organs for Bitcoin so they can make rent, you know, and feed their families. And atheist neoconservatives who want to bring secular liberalism to Iran with the, you know, 82nd Airborne. And yeah, I mean, given the choice, I would vastly prefer the kind of religious people who think that, you know, God wants them to stop wars and help poor people than atheists of that type. Right. I mean, this is just, there's just no, you know, I mean, I guess maybe we could, you know, we could try to do some sort of utilitarian calculation for like how many people will break which way if everybody stops believing in God. But I, for one, would have absolutely no idea how to even start doing that calculation, which is, you know, which is why I'm actually not particularly confident that, you know, about Christopher's implied argument that good and benevolent political consequences will come about from everybody having the right metaphysical beliefs. They might not, right? Like, I don't know. I think this is
boring centrist philosopher talk, Ben. We need extremist positions. We're on YouTube. Okay.
Oh, yeah. No, look, everything would be fine if people just stopped believing in this fucking stupid sky daddy.
Linear time doesn't exist. You need a two box.
Also, there's no linear time and two boxes. Two boxes is the correct view about Newcomb's paradox. And, you know, I can't believe you retards don't see that. Yeah. All right. There we go. I've done my 45 seconds as an epic based YouTube guy. and honestly, I was joking, but I still feel a little gross for having said all that. So it genuinely leaves a bad taste in my mouth. But yeah, like I don't think there's any guarantee that, you know, people come to the right, you know, that like people will come to the right political conclusions if they get the metaphysics right. I think that
well, I mean, Christopher Hitchens didn't.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. Right. And so, you know, to my mind, I mean, the reason to, you know, the reason to be an atheist is just because, you know, the evidence would strongly suggest that it's correct. And I would like to have correct beliefs, right? I'm curious about the world around me, and, you know, I want to, and, you know, to the extent that's possible, I want my beliefs about it to correspond to reality. And, you know, so I don't find all of that very compelling. But then the idea that, you know, the idea that empirically, you know, people are going to stop believing in God and start believing that everything is permitted and, you know, and settle all arguments with head kicking just doesn't seem to line up with the available evidence either. So it seems like once you abandon that, what's left of Peter's argument is that, well, without God, sure, empirically it might be the case that people keep on believing in morality, but maybe it'll be like irrational for them to do so, that their moral beliefs will no longer be coherent. You know, there's no magnetic force.
I mean, atheism does open the possibility that moral realism is wrong, but maybe moral realism is wrong.
Yeah. And so maybe Peter's idea is that people will, you know, maybe the charitable construction is that, you know, when theism falls, so too does moral realism, and that even if it's going to take people a few more generations to figure it out, they'll eventually figure this out. And then we'll have, you know, everybody will be stark naked running through the streets, you know, killing each other. And I don't particularly buy that one either, because whereas moral realism might or might not be correct, big, big issue, right? Very hard to settle. It's also not one that I think, you know, I think the idea that moral realism rises or falls with theism just doesn't really survive close examination. That, you know, that, you know, whether, I mean, it's a giant and interesting question whether there's any sense in which you could be objectively right or wrong about morality, what exactly it would mean to be objectively, you know, right or wrong about this. Is this ultimately just a claim about language, you know, that our moral terms, you know, latch onto certain things, and so, you know, you're like using them wrong use them in this, you know, if you use them in some other way than like the, you know, whatever way is objectively correct, that doesn't really seem to tell us much by itself about moral motivation. I'm not going to make any attempt to solve all of metaethics in the next 90 seconds. But
in the last 90 seconds, someone has been transphobic and saying I'm stealing valor.
Oh, okay. Sure. Minecraft Girls is. So I believe that account is operated by all the girls on Minecraft.
That's pretty cool. Ben, what's on the topic?
They all got together. Well, just real quick before we do that, right? Like, the reason I don't think that moral realism rises or falls with theism, that whatever's true about moral realism, like whatever difficult philosophical questions there are about making sense of moral realism, adding the assumption that God exists to your premise is going to do nothing to solve them. That, you know, it's going to, you know, that like that just going to be an irrelevance. It's not going to help. And the reason that I think so is because Plato, I think is very convincing on this point. That this is the Euthyphro argument. So basically, translated into the terms that we're talking about, if you think that you know, if you think that the morally right is that which God commands, you know, then does God command it because it's morally right, or is it morally right because he commands it? If God commands it because it's morally right, then there must be some other reason why it's morally right besides God commanding it. If God commands, you know, if it's only morally right because God commands it, then if God decided tomorrow that, you know, go forth and you know, and murder all the Minecraft girls was the was his will, then that would become morally right, right? So it ends up becoming this essentially parody of moral relativism. And this is, you know, I think there are moves that people make to try to get around this, but none of them are very convincing. Like, oh, well, maybe it's not God's commands. Maybe it's like morality is defined by like the fixed moral character of God, right? This is the sort of thing people say, but then that just pushes the question back a step, right? Like, well, if God has a certain moral character, why is that a good moral character to have? Is it just it's the one that God happens to have? Or does God have that one because he's, you know, essentially good or whatever, right? Like, I think that you just get a version of the same problem. And I find it incredibly frustrating that, you know, for all of the virtues of both of these guys that, you know, got both of them got lots of stuff wrong. Peter continues to get lots of stuff wrong. But, you know, they're both in many ways extremely interesting and, you know,
I mean, you'd rather them 1,000 times than Destiny or Ben Shapiro or whatever.
Exactly. Right. Totally. So yeah, normally I really enjoy reading, watching, listening to these guys, whatever I disagree with them about, but man, if you're going to be a defender of Western civilization at some point, you should get around to reading Plato.
Did you, do you remember that time when Ben Shapiro went on British TV with our like most right wing commentator and he called him a leftist? Deal, yeah.
Yeah, very different stormed away from the interview because he was clearly a biased lib.
Separated by a common language, as they say.
Yeah, no, that
like
was...
like headbangers.
No, that was a absolutely amazing moment that I just, yes, I enjoyed that so much. And yeah, this is not, you know, I don't know. I just, right now, the American right wing is not sending their best. And so... we just need to shut this down until we figure out what's going on. But
yeah, I mean, it might be a thing of just, you know, you don't want to say this about your apparent enemies, but it might be just the fact that they don't really have any good arguments. And thus there isn't really a possibility for them to be intellectualized, because as soon as you get intellectualized, you're like, oh, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. I mean, it is really striking that all of the smartest right-wingers in some way or another deviate from like the standard.
Yeah, they become very heterodox.
Admixture of things that
they go full mental, or they go like they try to be slightly serious about populism.
Yeah, exactly. Right, they either get a little serious about populism, your Amaris and Deneens, or they're at least somewhat consistent libertarians. So they have they end up abandoning a bunch of standard right wing views there. Or, you know, yeah, maybe they just become like completely insane opponents of modernity, but at least interesting.
I'm sure if you kind of tried to distill American liberalism down into a coherent set of beliefs, you'd have an incredible mess.
Yeah. I mean, I certainly don't doubt that, but let's, yeah. Owning the libs, we'll wait for another week.
I just read about Gnosticism.
Yeah, I still need to do Gnosticism. Not next week, though. Next week, I'm going to write basically a follow-up to that Jacobin article that everybody got mad about. And because it actually seems to me that there's an interesting philosophical issue that I wasn't even thinking about when I wrote it, but I think a lot of the subsequent discussion brought out, which is that a lot of people who, I'm just trying to come up with a nice neutral way to describe them. Let's say a lot of people who use the word decolonize a lot, right? A lot of those people have, in effect, without realizing it, a very libertarian way of thinking about justice, right? That if you, you know, that I think a very basic difference between leftists and libertarians is about whether justice is about process, right? That in other words, you know, that you haven't done certain kinds of bad things to people, or if you have, you've reversed it and undone the bad things and taken us back to some point in the past where you had a more just distribution, or whether it's about creating a more equal society going forward. And I think that a lot of these people have interestingly found themselves on the wrong side of that line. And it's interesting to kind of, you know, reflect on what that distinction is and why it matters.
Sorry, I was just noticing that my microphone was just picking up, I don't know, my fan noise or something there. But yeah.
Oh,
you're not actually going to be here next week.
No, I'm not going to be here next week, but we could talk about it the week after.
It's a shame, yeah, because I'm very interested in this whole indigeneity stuff and whatever.
No, we'll get into it. I was assuming, we're actually talking about the essay that was written this week, because like just out of this week and last week, that, you know, this is the one that, you know, you decided would be more interesting to talk about, but we can go back to being a week behind when we see each other in 2 weeks. Do you think you're gonna do something on your own next Sunday, or are you gonna? Okay.
I may as well try. I mean, went well. So
nice.
The only problem is it takes up my evening to do stuff. But I'll have to think of something, I guess, tomorrow, because I haven't got one yet.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. From the lamp ready for, I think that there's a lot of de facto Nozickianism in the decolonization crowd. But in any case, so we will get into that when we see each other in 2 weeks. And meanwhile, everybody can look forward to whatever Stefan is talking about next week. I don't know. This is the, you know, maybe you can bring on all the Minecraft girls to for a stimulating debate about, you know, whatever they're mad at you about.
All right, everyone. Bye.
Bye.